In March 1776, when the Continental Congress was psyching itself up to break with Britain, John Adams received a letter from his wife, Abigail.
I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favourable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could.
Abigail Adams had a point. In colonial America, wives remained dependents of their husbands, barred from holding their own property and rarely able to obtain a divorce. No women could vote, being regarded as idiots in the classical Greek sense of that word, people who were outside the political system. But in July 1776, America proclaimed itself independent from Britain in the name of liberty against tyranny. So why not a similar declaration of independence for women? Abigail warned John, only slightly tongue-in-cheek,
"If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation."
In the heady atmosphere of 1776, almost anything seemed possible. Some American women even gained the vote for a while. But as we'll see, John Adams and the other men who founded the United States didn't remember the ladies. Women's liberation would have to wait a couple of hundred years. During the war for American independence, politics was a matter of life and death, and women were drawn into the debate. In South Carolina, Eliza Wilkinson, the daughter of a local planter, recalled,
"None were greater politicians than the several knots of ladies who met together. All trifling discourse of fashions and such low chat were thrown by, and we commenced perfect statesmen. The men say we have no business with political matters. It's not in our sphere. But I won't have it thought that because we are the weaker sex as to bodily strength, we are capable of nothing more than minding the dairy, visiting the poultry house, and all such domestic concerns. We have as just a sense of honor, glory, and great actions as those lords of the creation."
Sometimes a woman openly defied her husband's political judgment. At one point in the war, when the British surrounded the town of Elizabeth in New Jersey, some of the men favoured surrender to avoid destruction. One of them was Isaac Arnott, but his wife Hannah was appalled, declaring publicly,
"For me, I stay with my country, and my hand shall never touch the hand, nor my heart cleave to the heart of him who shames her. Isaac, we have lived together for 20 years, but I am the child of God and of my country. And if you do this shameful thing, I will never again own you for my husband."
Sadly, we don't know whether their marriage survived. With so many husbands away at the war, wives had to work doubly hard to keep home and family together, often with little cash since soldiers were rarely paid. Some served as nurses or cooks, or were drawn into prostitution. Others marched with their husbands, and a few even saw combat. Joseph Martin, a soldier from Connecticut, recalled that during one battle in New Jersey,
"A woman attended with her husband at the artillery piece the whole time. While in the act of reaching a cartridge, and having one of her feet as far before the other as she could step, a cannon shot from the enemy passed directly through her legs without doing any other damage than carrying away the lower part of her petticoat. Looking at it with apparent unconcern, she observed that it was lucky it did not pass a little higher, for in that case it might have carried away something else."
From this story emerged the legendary figure of Molly Pitcher, a woman who carried water among the troops, quenching their thirst or cooling the guns. Given all these changes in women's roles, Judith Sargent Murray, a leading American writer, predicted,
"A new era of female history. The revolution of events is advancing in that half of the human species which hath hitherto been involved in the night of darkness, toward the irradiating sun of science."
During the American Revolution, some women even got the vote, a little-known story and well worth the telling. In July 1776, as the Declaration of Independence was promulgated, the Provincial Congress of New Jersey adopted a new constitution for that state, giving the vote to all free inhabitants who were of full age, worth at least £50, and had been residents of the state for at least a year. £50 wasn't a huge sum for the time, and most white males probably qualified. Although no married woman could meet the property qualifications, since everything they owned belonged legally to their husbands, many spinsters and widows were definitely eligible. So women played a significant role in New Jersey politics. In 1797, in the town of Elizabeth again, clearly a hotbed of feminism, 75 women supporters of the Federalist Party turned out en masse to vote. In those days, there was no secret ballot. Voting was a public act and readily open to intimidation. So the women showed considerable courage. Although victory went to their opponents, the Democrats, a poem in the New York Sentinel of Freedom proclaimed,
"Let Democrats with senseless prate maintain the softer sex, sir. Should ne'er with politics of state their gentle minds perplex, sir. Such vulgar prejudice we scorn. Their sex is no objection. While woman's bound, man can't be free, nor have a fair election."
But many New Jersey men denounced this petticoat revolution. A political commentator, William Griffith, considered the spectacle of women voting to be
"perfectly disgusting. It is evident that women, generally, are neither by nature, nor habit, nor education, nor by their necessary condition in society, fitted to perform this duty with credit to themselves or advantage to the public."
Eventually, New Jersey conservatives got their revenge. In 1807, after a backroom deal between the parties, the state legislature affirmed that voting was only for white males, so as to restore
the safety, quiet, good order, and dignity of the state.
New Jersey's tightening of the franchise was part of a general conservative backlash against the excesses of the revolutionary era. Yes, liberty was a good thing, but not if it upset the right ordering of society, and that meant keeping women in their place. So no U.S. state changed the laws under which a wife's property was absorbed into that of her husband, denying her any financial independence. A few, such as Massachusetts and Connecticut, allowed women to sue for divorce in civil courts. But much more typical was the sad story of the marriage of Nancy Shippen. It shows just how dependent women remained. Nancy was the beautiful teenage daughter of Dr. William Shippen of Philadelphia, who'd served as chief physician to Washington's army. During the war, she fell in love with Louis Otto, a young attaché at the French legation. But she was also courted by Colonel Henry Livingston, the son of a prominent New York family. Her father summed up their predicament, caught between two eligible but very different suitors.
"Nancy is much puzzled between Otto and Livingston. She loves the first and only esteems the last. On Monday, she likes Livingston and his fortune. On Tuesday evening, when Otto comes, he is the angel. Livingston will consummate immediately. Otto, not these 2 years. Livingston has solicited the father and mother. Otto is afraid of a denial. Livingston has 12 or 15,000 hard. Otto has nothing now but honorable expectations hereafter. They are both sensible. Otto, handsome. In short, we are all much puzzled."
Dr. Shippen decided, like many men of the time in such a position, that
"a bird in hand is worth two in the bush."
And so in 1781, Nancy, just 18, was married to Henry Livingston, a man almost twice her age. Right from the start, they proved totally incompatible. And even before her first and only child was born, Nancy had returned to her parents' home in Philadelphia. Back there, she felt an enormous surge of relief.
"I feel calm and composed, and please myself with the reflection of having conformed to the will of my parents in the most important action of my life. Oh, may I reap the benefit of it. I'm sure I shall. I have the sweetest child that ever was born. In her, I shall be most blessed.
But a month later...
Papa told me this morning at breakfast that I must send my darling child to its Grandmama Livingston. I told him I could not bear the idea of it, that I had sooner part with my life almost than my child. He told me it was for the future interest of my baby, that its fortune depended on the old lady's pleasure in that particular. When will my misfortunes end? I placed my happiness in her. She is my all, and I must part with her.
Nancy lost custody of her daughter Peggy to the Livingstons. She sought a divorce, but in New York, as in most states, this could only be obtained if some obliging man agreed to steer a private bill through the state legislature. No such knight in shining armour stepped forward, and eventually it was Nancy's philandering husband who ended the marriage. When Peggy came of age, she abandoned the Livingstons and moved in with her mother, now clinically depressed and estranged from her own parents. Nancy and Peggy lived out their days as lonely, reclusive old maids. The Shippen saga illustrates how little the fundamentals of women's lives had really changed. The founding fathers, radicals about liberty in public life, remained strict patriarchs in the home, women they believed should help the new republic indirectly by breeding and raising good citizens. John Adams told his daughter Nabby,
"There is a young generation coming up in America. You, my dear daughter, will be responsible for a great share of the duty and opportunity of educating a rising family, from whom much will be expected."
When Thomas Jefferson declared back in 1776 that all men were created equal, he used that word in the literal sense. Jefferson never believed women had a role to play in politics, and his experience in France on the eve of their revolution confirmed those feelings. He wrote home,
"The gay and thoughtless Paris is become a furnace of politics. Men, women, and children talk nothing else, but our good ladies, I trust, have been too wise to wrinkle their foreheads with politics. They are contented to soothe and calm the minds of their husbands, returning ruffled from political debate. They have the good sense to value domestic happiness before all other."
And as president, he wrote sternly,
"The appointment of a woman to office is an innovation for which the public is not prepared, nor am I."
In fact, the public didn't countenance such an innovation at any time in the 19th century. It wasn't until the era of the First World War that the US Congress welcomed its first female member, and women throughout the United States got the vote. Jefferson's taboo on office holding was finally broken in 1933 when President Franklin Roosevelt appointed a woman to his cabinet. As for the first female president, that American Revolution still lies in the future.